Hey, and welcome back to the Arizona Wildlife Federation podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm your host. And I am coming to you today from a very snowy Flagstaff, Arizona. The reason I point that out is because you might think this is an odd time to be airing a podcast about fire in Arizona and fire safety. But I will remind you, it is never too early to be thinking about this stuff. Spring is right around the corner, and so is fire season. With that said, I don't want you to tune out because, you know, safety things aren't always exactly the most exciting things to talk about. This podcast is way much more than that, and I'm very excited about it. This was a great talk, and I genuinely mean that. I got to sit down with Alex Fisher, kind of the founder of her fire safety advocacy group, Fired Up Flagstaff, and Matt McGroth. And Matt is the district director for the Forest Service. Both very knowledgeable people. You're not only going to learn about, the list goes on and on, you know, why fire is so dangerous up here, what's changed on the landscape that has made it so dangerous. You'll learn about the natural history of fire here and how the ecosystem's changed, what it should look like, what they're doing to get it and restore it back to its natural state, and protect communities from wildfire. And you're going to hear all about Alex's Fired Up Flagstaff, the work they're doing to educate visitors up here and locals as to fire dangers. So it is an interesting podcast. You'll hear about, you know, the methods they're using to manage our forest, you know, with the thinning and prescribed fire. You know, when you're driving along these forest roads and you see trees painted up with orange and blue paint, you're going to learn why and that is and the method behind it. So stick around. There is a lot to learn here. In my opinion, this is an extremely valuable discussion. And, you know, it's near and dear to me because I'm living up here and I'd like to keep my home. So with that, don't have any events for you, but I want to highlight a few events, one of which is the Outdoor Skills Network, just held their biannual meeting. And let me tell you, man, I always leave that meeting inspired. It is one of the few places I know of that folks from different political affiliations, different ideologies, old guard, new guard, everybody comes together and everybody has great discussions, open-minded discussions. And man, it's just refreshing, gives me a positive outlook, and gets me excited about the future of hunting and angling and outdoor recreation in our state. Some really good people there. And you know, I gotta give Doug Burt of Arizona Game and Fish Department big props because, yeah, I think his attitude, his personality, his organizational skills, that's what makes all of that possible there. I should also mention Jess Warner as well from the National Wild Turkey Federation. He plays a big role in putting all this together, and, you know, Jess is a buddy and a great guy, and he definitely adds to the flavor of that meeting as well. So good people doing good work, and yeah, I wouldn't miss that meeting for the world. If you're interested in that and you're involved with an organization, reach out. We'll talk about it. I'll let you know how to get involved. Let's see, other news. Arizona Backcountry Hunters and Anglers just held their annual planning meeting. Lots of exciting stuff on the horizon for next year. We have got, I should say, this year. There's numerous pint nights being planned, so keep an eye open in your area for one of those pint nights. Come out, have a few beers, or not, with some of your fellow hunters and anglers. Talk about conservation, talk about your season. It is a good time, I promise. I go to everyone that I can. Other big things coming up. This year, we're going to, of course, do our squirrel camp, which is one of my favorites. We're going to do our three hunt and camp, where we take new hunters out and show them the ropes, show them how to be safe and have a good time. We are going to have our annual dove cook-off in September. That's a great one. And a lot of other things planned in there and throughout the rest of the year, including something that we haven't done, but we should do because most of us are fishermen. God knows I am. We're going to do a fly fishing event, potentially out in the White Mountains, potentially somewhere else. So keep an ear for that. Turkey season is right around the corner. The end of our javelina hunts are coming up. Me and my little boy have a tag here at the end of February that I cannot wait to get out. I've got a bad case of cabin fever this winter. It's really rough. So I am so looking forward to that camp and that hunt. But also, there are lots of youth turkey hunts going on that a lot of different organizations are hosting, and they always need help. So keep an eye out on our podcast for announcements there. You can reach out to groups like the Elk Society and the Wild Turkey Federation. And you could keep it also really convenient and just go to the Outdoor Skills Network page hosted by Arizona Game and Fish Department and get all of these events right there. You know, if you got some free time this spring and you'd like to go out and help a young hunter bag his first turkey, or you'd like to go out and just help with the camp, you can cook, you can do dishes, whatever. There's if you want to help, there's a position for you to do so. It feels good and it's fun. So I recommend looking into those opportunities. All right, with all of that, please enjoy this very important discussion with Matt and Alex. I know you're going to learn a ton. Thanks. See you after the show. All right, welcome you two.
Good morning.
Let's get started with some introductions. Let's start with you, Alex.
Sure. So my name's Alex Fisher. I'm part of a small community group here in Flagstaff called Fired Up.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And I assume you're here for at least a similar reason as I think this should be important to everybody, but everybody in this room lives here.
Yes.
And all you have to do is get through one summer here. Mm-hmm. And it becomes very, very real, you know, why this is important, you know, why we need to talk about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It changes your worldview for sure.
Yeah, it does. All right, Matt, how about you?
My name is Matt McGrath. I'm the district ranger for the Flagstaff Ranger District on the Coconino National Forest here surrounding the city of Flagstaff.
Great. Could you tell me a little bit about what you do?
Sure. I'm the district ranger. So I'm responsible for about 850,000 acres surrounding the city of Flagstaff, San Francisco Peaks, Kachina, Mountain Air, Munns Park. And basically, as the district ranger, I'm responsible for everything that goes on the National Forest. So here on the forest, we do on the Coconino, we do a lot of forest restoration work, which we're going to talk a little bit about, fire, but also very active recreation programs, wildlife, range, cultural resources. We do just about everything here.
Right on. Do you know Patrick Moore?
I do. I actually know two Patrick Moores.
Oh, do you? All right. Well, the one I'm talking about is a very big character, and he's a bird hunter. That's how I know him.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Great guy. A lot of fun to hang out with. And Alex, of course, we got you here for a very specific reason, and we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
But all right, let's jump into this then. Let's talk about what the danger is up here. Of course, we're talking about fire. Last year was a very bad season. But Matt, could you somehow encompass just how dangerous wildfire or even residential fire is up in our neck of the woods or throughout Arizona and our forested regions?
Sure. One of the things I think is really important to acknowledge up front is that we live in a fire dependent ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So fire is natural here. We need fire here. And a lot of the issues that we're facing now are actually because we've excluded fire for 20, 50, 100 years. Mm-hmm. So this is a fire-dependent ecosystem. However, now we have about 100,000 people living right in the middle of it. So it's a really difficult balance in trying to restore natural conditions to the forest, including fire, while protecting our communities.
Right, right. Yeah, I have a 10-year-old little boy at home who, fortunately for me, loves the outdoors. He's all into survival right now. It's funny. I let him set like snares for squirrels that he reads about in the books. I know he's not going to catch anything. The animals in our yard are off limits to harming. But still, I'll let him do this stuff because I know they're safe. And but part of that is he wants to make fire all different ways. You know, he wants to try it with flint and steel or with char cloth. And you know, I encourage that because I think it's cool. I enjoy that stuff too. But in the summertime, it is absolutely off limits. And fortunately, I've got a pretty wise little child, and he understands that and he follows the rules. But yeah, I'm not gonna lie, man, it terrifies me in the summer how quickly and how easily it has to light something up. It's nuts. But
you know what's interesting is here our conditions are so variable from year to year. So this is going to be my fifth season here. So I got here right around in January of 2019, and that was the previous year, 2018, it was so dry and conditions were so extreme that they actually closed the forest for 5 or 6 weeks, quite a long time. And I got here, we had in February, it was called Snowmageddon at the time. We got like 40 inches of snow in a day. And then we continued to have kind of a wet, cool spring. And that was my introduction to Northern Arizona. I said, oh, this is great.
Not so bad.
And we actually wound up not going into any kind of fire restrictions at all that season in 2019. So in 2018, it was so hot and dry that we closed the forest. And then 2019, we didn't even prohibit campfires anywhere because it was so so damp and humid and moist that a fire wasn't going to carry and it wasn't a real danger. Mm-hmm. 2019 was a bit of an aberration, although it depends. You know, if you look back 22 years, there have been 5 years where we've closed the forest due to extreme fire danger. And then there have been 4 or 5 years where we had no restrictions at all. And so it just kind of varies. However, over the last 5 years, 3 of those years, we've had some sort of forest type closure, whether that's the entire forest or certain areas.
Yeah.
Because it really depends on the season and the year. And so like we've had a pretty good winter so far. I check the weather regularly, and our fire folks actually have a direct line to the meteorologists at the Weather Service, mm-hmm. and also the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. So they get better information than I do. But, you know, looking at the storm, like maybe an inch on Sunday. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, 6 and maybe more inches coming right. next week. And so we keep a real close eye on that.
Right.
Because, you know, it could all shift quickly if we have a hot or a mild, dry, windy spring like we often do.
Yeah.
But this is certainly a great start.
Good start.
And so we just keep rooting for this to continue
right.
through the spring.
Yeah. You know, I was sitting here talking with Alex before we started recording about our short-sightedness as a human species, you know, and how we kind of we're wired to deal with the immediate, you know, and we really struggle, you know, especially as a society looking forward and planning ahead. And it's funny, you know, even looking at, you know, the last 20 years of what's happened here, it's you know, all right, I should be careful. There is a mountain of evidence that points to a changing, drying, warmer climate in the Southwest. And that's likely what we're going to be dealing with. But, you know, when we're sitting here right now with a bunch of snow on the ground out there, and it's been this is my first, well, second winter up here. Last winter was pretty mild.
Yeah.
And it has been. Just living in a rural area through these winters is a steep learning curve.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping next year will go a little smoother. But so it's easy to forget, you know, when I'm dealing with all this snow, that just how dry it was last summer.
Last winter is a great example. We had a great December and then kind of turned off. And then January on, we barely had any snow at all.
Yeah.
And then we had a dry, windy spring, and the tunnel fire was April 18th, I believe, really early in our season. So, you know, that's why we look at next week. Okay, more snow, and we keep hoping for more and more. But things here can turn pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah, yeah, can. Let's talk a little bit about what has changed. Like you already mentioned, this is a fire dependent ecosystem. Mm-hmm. It evolved with fire. It needs fire. Let's talk a bit about what those fires used to be like versus what they're like now, and what has changed to make it that way.
Yeah, so I'm, you know, I've been here for 4 years, and I've seen some changes myself, and acknowledging that I'm not a climate scientist. But one thing that I've noticed in talking to some of my fire folks who've been here for 20 or more years, and we have retirees who've been here for 40, 50 years, like they have seen a tremendous change in fire behavior, right? And so fires are generally, or oftentimes now, more extreme, more explosive, harder to control. A good example, I think, is in 2021, we had the Slate Fire, which was northwest of town. So if you go up Highway 180, past Snowball, through Fort Valley, past Snowball, you get up to past Kendrick Peak, Slate Mountain, which is actually a great hike, one of the best views you'll find on the forest. It's not a very difficult hike either, because you have views of Kendrick, of the peaks, and it's just a really great spot. But that's up in, you know, as the northern part of our district kind of transitions from ponderosa pine to pinyon juniper country. And when I got here, everyone said, well, you know, when a fire hits the pinyon juniper, you know, there's not a lot of ground cover. Usually it'll fizzle out. You know, if there's a wind, it'll carry, but it takes a lot for the pinyon and juniper to catch. So, you know, a fire gets out there, you can kind of stop worrying about it. Well, a fire there started basically in the pinyon juniper and just ripped through it for 11 or 12 days. And frankly, it was pushing us around every single day.
Wow.
Because it has gotten the long-term drought, and those trees are so stressed. And actually, if you go out Highway 89 heading up towards Page,
I was going to mention that one.
That is a great example, because about a year and a half ago, we started getting a lot of calls from people and saying, oh, is it some sort of, well, it wouldn't be the bark beetle, obviously. Is there some sort of beetle or insect infestation in those trees? And so we actually sent our silviculturists out there to take a look. And there is none. Yeah. It is just drought.
Turning brown.
That is what it was. And there's really nothing that we can do about that.
Right.
And so that's one of the things, I think, that long-term drought has really played a role in it. And so, you know, we're talking about a great winter right now. And that's fantastic. We had an okay winter last year. But it's going to take a lot of great winters to really reverse the long-term drought. If you look at the map now, you know, the map will say that we're it's moderate drought. It's not extreme anymore. And that's great. However, like you said, short-term, people can be short-term focused. Like, a good winter or two is not going to fix the long-term drought.
Yeah, you mentioned the 89, and you know, even our Sonoran Desert are burning up, which, as I understand it, is not a thing that was, you know. Yeah, that was the brush fire?
Bushfire.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was devastating. Yeah. And it's such a depressing drive through there now, you know, entire mountains, which is black or was. But yeah, scary stuff. And so can we talk a bit about logging practices, how they're contributing to this? You know, what have we done to the landscape to make these fires more extreme?
So there is, if you look at the history of Flagstaff, there is a very strong timber history in the community going back, you know, into the early 20th century. And then, like a lot of places, it started to, you know, reduce as the century went by. And so really the biggest change that we made, whether it was through logging or people moving in, was the exclusion of fire. So that was a big piece. So, you know, traditionally in a ponderosa pine forest, when it was not, you know, they logged it and then it started to grow back. And normally a fire would roll through, you know, the estimate varies, but 5, 6, 7, 10 years is pretty regular for a fire to roll through a ponderosa pine forest.
Okay.
There shouldn't be a lot of small trees on the ground because they burned in the fire 10 years ago.
Right.
And so the big trees, the fire just rolls through, burns the new growth, and doesn't affect the long-term growth, the canopies. And so that's how it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
So what started to happen was we would exclude that fire because people were living or using the forest. And so that new growth would start to grow. A fire would come through when we didn't want it to. And those would provide fuel for it to then burn up the big trees, get into the canopy, and cause a more catastrophic fire.
Right.
And so what I think folks here have recognized, and this goes back quite a while, and we talk about forest restoration, and when I talk about this, nobody's making a profit from cutting trees in Northern Arizona anymore. A lot of times people think, oh, the Forest Service is trying to make money. More often than not, we're paying people to take trees off of the forest rather than them making a lot of money on it. But you know, looking back to the Four Forest Restoration Initiative that started in 2010 or so, and then really the community acknowledging that we needed to do some more work to restore the forest was the Flagstaff Watershed Protection Project, which was in 2012, I believe, when the community passed a levy to raise millions of dollars, tax themselves, to pay for forest restoration work in Mount Eldon and the Dry Lake Hills. So commercial timber plays a huge role for us in trying to restore the forest to as natural as we can get it, considering we've got 100,000 people living right in the middle, and then small towns, you know, neighborhoods, Kachina Mountain Air, Belmont Parks, all these small towns scattered about the forest. So try to commercially thin the forest, and then reintroduce fire. So try to mimic that natural process as best we can as humans. I think we all know humans cannot replace nature, but we can do our best to try to do that.
Sure.
And so that's really all the majority of the work that we're doing here is, and this is an example is along, well, on in the Dry Lake Hills, which the Flagstaff Watershed Protection Project, we're just about finished. Actually, almost all of the thinning work is done. They're hauling a few more loads out and plowing the road to get through the snow, hauling some loads out. And then what's left behind are the slash piles. So the trees come out and there's absolutely no value in the branches and the needles. Pile those up and try to burn them. This great winter we've had, actually, we had a lot of piles in the Dry Lake Hills that were kind of, I don't want to say scary to me, but like we would look at them when it was hot and dry and be like, man, these, you know, it's dangerous having those out there. That's the game we play, is we increase the fire danger a little bit. But this great winter we've had and our folks hoofing it up the side hill in 10 or 12 inches of snow, most of December, there was a string of 18 out of like 24 days when they were burning piles up there.
Yeah.
So we were able to complete a lot of that work.
That's great.
And so ideally now, I mean, obviously we do not want any fires in that area. You know, we do need fire in that area. That's the whole thing is like, we can't keep it out forever.
Right.
However, if it is as natural conditions as possible, if we do get a lightning strike up there, we're doing everything we can to keep humans from causing it. If we do get a lightning strike, it will either one, we'll be able to suppress it because it's too dangerous, or it will just kind of, you know, do its thing, burn a couple hundred acres, maybe 1,000 acres, and then fizzle out on its own.
Right.
And you see the photos, you know, back in the day, 100 years ago, of the forest. It's almost unrecognizable. Yeah. It almost looks like fields with large ponderosas in it. And now I drive to Sedona to visit my family, my in-laws, and you drive by and you can hardly see through the forest. They're so they're so small and thin. It's just crazy.
One of the really interesting things that I learned when I got here, we have, even before the COVID boom happened, we had a lot of second homes up here. And I think that, you know, now even more with Airbnbs and stuff, but it's the second home folks from the Valley. And I don't ever badmouth the Valley. I love the Valley. But folks would have a second home and it would be adjacent to the forest. And then they would come home one day and they would see orange paint on the trees, which means that we're you know, in 6 months or a year, we're planning on doing some cutting there. And I would get a phone call. I'm like, don't mess up my beautiful forest. And I would have to explain to them, like, you think that's a beautiful forest. And maybe it is a beautiful forest, but that's not what it's supposed to look like. Right. And that's exactly, Alex, what you were saying.
Yeah.
Is people think this real, they have this vision of this really dense, thick forest. And yes, it can be beautiful, but that's not what it's supposed to look like here in Northern Arizona.
Right. Yeah. I did want to touch on that. One of the things that I find fascinating, and I'm kind of giddy I got them in my own yard, is we have those original stumps from those primary forests. Which gives us a map to what these forests look like. And my little acre southwest facing slope is you know what they refer to as a pine choked hellhole. And I'm working on it. I've taken a bunch of trees out. I'm going to take a bunch more. Don't get me wrong. I want to live in the woods. That's why I went out there. But I want to live in healthy woods.
Yep.
And I'd love to get some fire on it too. I just haven't figured out how to do that safely. Maybe I can talk to you about that after this. But
you know, an example of like those stumps and how things have changed is in the Hart Prairie area on the west side of the peaks, which it's a prairie, right? There shouldn't be a lot of trees, but through excluding fire, we've wound up having trees encroaching on the prairie and on the meadows. And so some of the work we've been doing, it's less of a fuels mitigation or fire mitigation, but it's just trying to restore these prairies to what they're supposed to, these historic prairies to what they're supposed to look like. So we've been doing some work out in those areas as well.
Yeah. And it pleases me greatly that's the aim, you know, kind of that natural landscape, you know, I'm assuming, you know, you leave more trees on northern slopes and things like that. I think it's important to have that as part of the management plan, you know, outside of just safety and what's good for the communities. But, you know, try to reach for that, you know, pre-European settlement state, you know, the way these forests are supposed to look. All right. Let's see where we're going to go next. I want to talk about, you know, how these get started. But I think a big part of that is why we have Alex here. So I'm trying to like parse this out where it all makes sense. But let's talk about how some of these fires start naturally. How about that?
Sure. So, we live in here on up above the rim. You know, monsoon season is our big active season. And so when the majority of our fire season is May through early May, traditionally, I should say, early May through, say, July 10th. You know, you ask somebody when monsoon season ends. Some people say it's July 4th, July 5th. It's roughly on our statistics. It's around July 10th historically. So that's our fire season, because a lot of that is getting dry lightning storms, or they hit the rim, the moisture gets ringed out by the time they get here up, you know, around town. It's mostly dry lightning, and that's how this place is supposed to be. And so trying to get to a place where we can use those lightning strikes to naturally manage fire in some areas. And example of that, down Turkey Butte area a couple of years ago, in 2019, that great season, that great winter and wet spring that we had. Actually, we had several natural fires out along the rim, and let some of them burn for a couple extra days rather than go and just hit it hard and put it out at 5 acres. We had two that were about 4,000 acres each, 4,000 or 5,000 acres, called the Whiskey Fire and the Saber Fire. And, you know, we got some calls from the community, because that was directly upwind or downwind from the community. And so, the smoke is blowing right here into town, and folks didn't like that. But that was 2019. And that was some great treatment of clearing out a lot of that brush and those small trees down on the ground. Fast forward 2 years, 2021, where we had the Raphael Fire, which actually started on the Prescott National Forest, burned onto the Kaibab, and then came, I'll say, roaring up Sycamore Canyon, up onto the Coconino. There's actually a spot where the Prescott, the Coconino, and the Kaibab all come together. And the fire was burning up there. And one evening, it was burning up onto the ridge up there. And had it kept going, it would have dropped down in Oak Creek Canyon, which then feeds into Pump House Wash, which then goes to Kachina and Mountain Air, and is a really scary thought. However, this fire that was completely out of control hit those two managed fires that we had from 2 years ago, the Whiskey Fire and the Sabre Fire, and didn't go out. But it kind of sat down and mm-hmm. it just sort of burned through it. There was still some fuel for it to burn. But it was able to, it really moderated behavior one night. Our fire folks were able to catch it and keep it from dropping into Oak Creek Canyon. So I mean, that's an example of where, you know, not only do we need fire, we want fire in many areas right. on this landscape. Obviously we don't want it here in the community, but we want it because it is a huge tool for us in preventing a catastrophic fire from impacting town.
Right. Yeah. I want to get to, you know, how a lot of these fires get started, and basically, you know, irresponsible behavior and accidents. Yeah. And I want to get to how folks like Alex here are working to mitigate that. But before we move on to that, and I realize I'm jumping around a little bit here, you mentioned the orange paint on trees earlier. And I will say that there is all still, even folks that live here that should be very much tuned in to what's happening and why it's happening. They still get very angry, you know, and I get it. I don't like, you know, seeing orange paint all over trees and a bunch of tractors, you know, out in the forest cutting two tracks and stuff. But the end product here is what matters. Yeah. And it's not going to be like that forever. But folks get angry about it. You know, folks that live in very dangerous areas get upset about this. So, well, one, you know, I'd like to talk about what is some outreach to educate these folks? And two, could you explain the whole orange paint system so people know what they're seeing whenever they drive down the road and see all these orange
sure.
trees?
You know, so we're constantly trying. We actually live in a really savvy community. On balance, folks get it. A lot of folks understand we need fire. And we
I'm
need,
out in parks. We need, they don't get it out there.
I said on balance, not everybody. But, you know, a really educated, thoughtful uh-huh. community that gets it. They still don't like breathing smoke when they don't have to, but that's understandable. And so we're doing constantly a lot of outreach. And like I said, a lot of times it's when people just see it and they give me a phone call and say, hey, what's going on out mm-hmm. here? The blue, a lot of times folks will see either orange paint or blue paint. Mm-hmm. And so the anatomy of a thinning project is, you know, we identify an area that needs to be treated. We go out, have a silviculturist who's, you know, a professional forester, writes the prescription, says, okay, we need to remove this many trees. There should be, say, 70 trees per acre instead of there's currently 200. So we need to take out, you know, this percentage and something like that. Then we have folks go out and lay out the sale and actually mark it. And those are the folks who are out with the paint. And so if you see orange paint, that means that we're going to come through and we're going to cut the trees that don't have paint on them. Orange is a leave tree. Yep. If you see blue paint, blue is we're going to cut it. And the difference is if we're whichever one we need to use less paint is how we're going to do it. Okay. You know, if we're cutting less trees or fewer trees, then we'll just mark those with blue paint. But if we're going to be cutting more trees and leaving fewer, then we'll mark the fewer trees.
All right.
Because that's not just orange paint that you go get at Home Depot.
Sure.
It's actually pretty expensive so that we could track yeah. it. And so that's really what it is. So if you see either orange or blue paint, there's some sort of project that's going to be going on up there,
okay.
Whether it's a commercial project or a hand thin. A lot of times, you know, we're talking about major commercial activity, but a lot of times we have youth crews or tribal right. crews go in and just do some hand thinning of smaller trees, like I said, to reduce those fuels that could carry something up into the canopy of the bigger trees.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to backpedal a little bit here because I want my neighbors in parks to listen to this and I don't want them to think that I think that they're all, you know, misinformed on this stuff. Cause I have some wonderful neighbors and it's a great community that all comes together to help each other. And it's something I value very much. But yeah, on their, you know, Facebook page, I think every community's got a Facebook page now. I do hear a lot of fussing about forestry projects that are going on yep. in the area. And I want folks to know why they're there and why they should value them. So what about outreach? I mean, is the Forest Service trying to reach out and educate folks on this stuff?
Constantly. Yeah. We're doing that all the time, not only on overall on the overall forest restoration, which, you know, we've been talking a lot about the thinning piece. We've been talking about fire, but it's all of those things. We're outreach effort on forest health, which includes Forest restoration, which is maybe thinning, maybe fire, but it's also about public behavior and how to responsibly recreate on the forest, how to responsibly live in the community and live out adjacent to the forest is a big part of it. So gotcha. Basically, anytime we're invited anywhere, we show up at a lot of community meetings. This is my I did two this week, and this one, you know, may have potentially a broader reach. We've got two scheduled for next week. You know, if folks want to hear more about this, they just reach out to us and we find them and work with the city and the county a lot when they're having meetings with some of the neighborhoods. Like earlier this week, I was out with the folks out in Doney and Timberline. Right. And so talking to folks and just constantly reinforcing, like, this is what this forest is supposed to look like. We need to do this work.
Yeah.
And the community has basically recognized that either through Fort Fry or Flagstaff Watershed Protection Project and is generally pretty receptive to it.
Right. Right. Well, Matt, I certainly appreciate everything you're doing. I appreciate you being here today. Obviously, I live here. It's near and dear to me. Mm-hmm. It's very important. And I want to move into, the people problem side of this. Mm-hmm. And before we do that, Alex, I want to go ahead and talk about what you've done, because you're a big part of the solution to that problem. Thanks. So you want to tell us about Fired Up Flagstaff?
Yeah. So this came about a couple ways. I previously worked for Coconino County, so I had the honor of being part of the Emergency Operations Center as the Joint Information Center Section Chief. It's quite a mouthful. But essentially, I helped the Coconino County Sheriff get out the word when evacuations needed to happen. Yeah. That was kind of a life-changing experience for me and really felt pretty helpless. We're getting the word out there, but in terms of prevention, it just started getting my wheels spinning. So I got some friends and family together who live here in the community and just said, what can we be doing that helps this problem before it becomes a fire in our communities? And we saw houses burn down last summer, and it's really devastating. So one thing that we noticed is our wonderful partners in the government world, are getting the word out there to locals and to residents. What we felt like in terms of, prevention measures, what it means to be fire wise, how to keep your community and your home safe. But what we felt like was potentially lacking or could have more done around was those visitors who come to our communities. And how are we getting the word out there that, it's not a good idea to light a backyard fire in the summer in Flagstaff? And, 10 years ago, perhaps those visitors coming up from Phoenix and other places were staying in hotels. Now they're staying next door in short-term rentals and Airbnbs. So I live here in Flagstaff in University Heights. I'm surrounded on all sides by Airbnbs. And, we all have different thoughts about perhaps Airbnbs and short-term rentals, but the reality is they're here and they're staying next door. And I'd love for them to know that it's dangerous sometimes. So that's what my friends and I got together to do. And, an approach that we decided to take was, there's so many ways to reach people, right? There's social media, there's, digital ads and all sorts of things. But what we thought was getting people on vacation mode to look at a social media account. I mean, it's far-fetched, I think. So we got together and we tried to use really plain language, funny language to create these rat cards that people can leave on the doorstep or the door or the windshield when new folks come and stay next door.
Awesome. I mentioned to you before, I feel like this should have been an obvious niche, and maybe it was to you, but it's one that needed filled.
Thanks.
And I mean that. I think it's extremely important. And you're right. The folks that live up here, they have a little bit better of a handle on the situation, at least the danger there. And folks coming up from the valley, they might just not know.
Right.
Well,
I mean, I didn't know when I moved here. I'm an Arizona native, but when I moved here, I had no concept that someone could tell me I couldn't have a charcoal grill in my on in my backyard, my private property. Yeah. Certainly, I wouldn't expect an Airbnb-er who's on vacation mode. They come up to our forest to light a fire. They come up to have s'mores and enjoy a cigar, whatever it is. So, we're not trying to be our group Fired Up Flagstaff. We're not trying to be experts on fire restrictions. We are simply trying to get the idea of fire safety into the minds of people who are on vacation mode. And we're doing it in sort of a sassy way. I see you laughing as you're reading it.
No,
so
these are wonderful.
We're saying things that we know our friends in the Coconino National Forest and Coconino County and City of Flagstaff can't say.
Right.
We are just, locals who can and say some sassy, funny things to get people's attention.
You need something to get attention, because
in this
people don't like being told what to do.
No.
And two, you know, I'm a busy person.
Right. And we don't want people to feel unwelcome. I mean, there's lots of thoughts about Flagstaff and residents can sometimes feel like, oh, you know, tourists are coming up, but we rely on tourists for our economy. That is Flagstaff. Oh, yeah. And so, absolutely. You know, we need to kind of acknowledge that. And so one of the phrases on this RAT card that we hand out is, you know, we love visitors. We want people to feel welcome. Mm-hmm. And we hope they burn. We say, hope you burn lots of cash at our shops and businesses. Just don't burn anything else. You know, we want you here. You're welcome. But let's just be safe and wise.
I'm just going to read a couple of these. Okay. Okay. So s'mores, not worth it. Don't be an asshole.
That's a bad one. Yeah.
Cut gas. No, but I think it's great because, you need something to grab the attention of folks. And I think this is perfect.
So
Michael, you know, you were asking me earlier about how the Forest Service is communicating. And I rattled off a lot of community meetings, local stuff.
Yeah.
And like you said, this is a huge need that we have not been able to figure out. Like, how do we communicate? Because we have a huge number of folks coming up from the Valley. So we're really excited about the work that Alex and her friends are doing to try to help reach those people. Because a lot of it, like she said, she didn't know when she first got here. And I was out with one of our prevention folks, and they basically drive around the forest and look for fires. And they're more of an education role. Mm-hmm. And we met a really wonderful family from the Valley, and they're having a fire. I think we were in stage one restrictions, which says no fires just out on the forest, but it's not, you know, extreme danger. And I think they had a charcoal grill and they had no idea. Like they had no idea that they were doing anything wrong. And so we had a great conversation with them and we're able to educate them. But again, that's like, we just stumbled upon them out on the forest. Mm-hmm. So like, we're not going to get everybody that way.
Right.
So the work that Alex and her group are doing is just incredibly helpful to us.
Yeah.
So we ask people if you like I said, I'm surrounded on all sides by Airbnbs. I'm not at home all the time, but I still know when a new family has arrived, there's new cars in the driveway. So I think the best approach and what we're trying to do is, you know, folks who live next door to short-term rentals, folks who own or operate short-term rentals, you know, contact us. I'll share our phone number and our email address, and we'll get you some of these RAT cards so that when new people come into town, you just slip this on their windshield, you just put this on their front door. Because it really is the community that has their finger on the pulse of who's in town, who's visiting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. Two of our best friends have an Airbnb, and I'm going to utilize these for them.
Great. Yeah. We say put them on the fridge, put them in your welcome packet. And, you know, it's kind of a smaller approach, but, you know, we have dreams and hopes that we can work with Airbnb and say, hey, at certain times of the year on all Flagstaff area listings, it says extreme fire danger. You know, the time that you're booking is an extreme fire danger.
Yeah.
But for now, this is kind of the boots on the ground like way that we're trying to get people aware.
Right. Right. Well, I think it's fantastic. I like seeing people do things because it's the right thing to do. And you don't always see that, you know, you're not the average person. So I commend you for, you know, going the extra mile, and, you know, we're all busy these days. So sometimes it's hard.
And I think people want to feel like they're doing something. You know, you feel so helpless when you see a fire. My husband, he did the research a couple of years ago. He's like, oh, maybe I could be a volunteer firefighter. He's too old. So this is one way that we can help. If we can't be out there on the front lines, like, what can we be doing in our community? So, and this is our second season of doing Fired Up, of passing out these flyers. Mm-hmm. And there's an appetite. You post one time on Nextdoor or Facebook, people are desperate to do something and feel safe in their own homes. And every fire expert that I've spoken to, like Matt, you know, there's a lot of concern, and if not more concern, about fire starting in neighborhoods, just due to the risk to life and property. So I think it's kind of a shift, because I think we think wildfires, we think forest fires, we think out of town. That's not the case always, as we've seen in places like Colorado.
So, you know, usually we'd save this for the end of the show, but where can folks contact you? Because I'd like to bring this up to my community and let them know how to get a hold of these pamphlets.
That's great. So you can call us 928-421-2444 or email us at firedupflagstaff@gmail.com. So last year we were just driving out to people's homes and giving them flyers and making contact. This year I'm hoping we can have some more partnerships with whether it's local businesses or fire stations so people can take it into their own hands and pick them up. And so that's what we're hoping this year, to get all these RAT cards out into the community.
Awesome. Well, let's move into like how some of these accidents happen. Mm-hmm. You know, last year, I am a huge, huge fan and advocate of our public lands. It's literally why I'm in Arizona and not back home in Missouri where I'm from, because we don't have this resource, and it's something I value very much. And, you know, I'm human. I think everybody should do things the way I do them, but I'm also realistic, and I'm pro multi-use, as hard as that can be sometimes for me. I try to keep an open mind and realize these forests belong to all of us, and not just me, and people have a lot of different ways they like to recreate on them. And last year, one of our big fires here in Flagstaff started. I think there was a gentleman living up there for the summer, and I get more power to him, you know, because I think, you know, for some people that's an exciting, adventurous way to live. Some people have to do it, but you know, that guy's not looking at regulations. He's not checking to see if fires are allowed at a certain time before he sets one. So then there's also, I'll give you one quick story. All right, last year, and I'm forgetting the names. We had the two big fires last year.
Tunnel and Pipeline.
Yeah. All right. I believe it was after the Tunnel fire. I believe. Would that have been around May that was wrapping up?
Yes. Okay. Early May.
So I was spring turkey hunting. I was just south of Flagstaff, kind of above, I believe it's Pump House Wash. And up on a windy ridge, it's about 11 a.m. Winds are kicking up. They're kicking up on both sides of this ridge. And I come into a campsite. There's sparks flying everywhere. And I mean, conditions could not have been worse. And it was terrifying. There's nobody anywhere. And there's cigarette butts on the ground that they didn't even stomp them out. They just let them burn down. You know, the ash was, you know, 2 inches of ash still just sitting there attached to it. And it's so, so disheartening to see that. You know, and you know, there's bad apples, and you know, I would say maybe these people were just misinformed with the cigarette thing. Yeah, I'm gonna call them bad apples. You know, they're in every group, no matter what group you look at. There's people that are out there doing it wrong and kind of make everybody look bad. And this is the sort of thing that leads to your regulations that affect all of us, unfortunately. But so those are just examples of what I've seen. How else, you know, other than just poor camping practices, people lighting fires when they shouldn't be, which I think anyone that uses our public lands regularly and is out recreating during these fire bans, you're going to see people with campfires all the time.
Yeah.
So how do you handle those situations? Do you have recommendations? And what else are people doing to make mistakes and cause these fires?
So when we're looking at human caused fires, the two main ways, one that you described, is folks just want a campfire or potentially maybe flick a cigarette. And the other is dragging chains with a trailer. And that's huge on the 89 here, east of town, by my office and by my house. And sometimes, you know, I get a text every time we have any fire reported on the forest. And you know, one day I got one, and it was like five in a row, like a half mile away from each other, going up 89 up to the monument. And it was, that's very obviously somebody dragging chains. And, okay. You know, the ADOT does a great job trying to educate people on that. When you're coming up from the valley, you see the signs and they'll say, usually they say extreme fire danger or fire danger. And they'll say, don't drag chains. There's a huge effort, but people, you know,
Patrol look out for that kind of stuff?
I think they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a lot of times, you know, you don't really notice it until the sparks kick off into the grass. And oftentimes over there in the grass, it's not, you know, a huge deal, but certainly something that we don't want to do. You know, you'd mentioned, you know, the fire started by someone last year living on the forest. You know, I will mention that living on a national forest is illegal all the time. We do have a 14-day stay limit where folks can come and stay. And we have a variety of people who stay on the forest for longer than 14 days. You know, some folks are just here in the summer, you know, with a $200,000 RV.
Yep.
And this is a great place to stay, right? Sure. And you can be 15 minutes or fewer from Flagstaff, and you disconnect and you drive your truck into town and you hang out and you have a great time. And why would you go anywhere else? Like, you don't want to go back somewhere else. And then we have folks who are living on the forest really because they have no other choice.
Yeah.
And they have nowhere else to go. And so how we manage that population, where if they had somewhere else to go, they'd probably go there, but they don't. And so how do we work with that group and with other partners to prevent them from starting another fire like we saw last year?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm sure there's not a good answer for this question, or the answer would be just don't engage. But, you know, we were in my family, and I have two little ones, and my wife were backpacking Bear over in the White Mountains, goes up Mount Baldy, does a loop. mm-hmm. around Little Colorado. Yeah. I forget the name of the trail, but about, I don't know, 14 mile loop or something. And you know, as we're hiking through, the trail goes through a series of parks along Little Colorado, then kind of goes up into the wooded hillsides. And it was during a time that fires were restricted. And of course, you know, right at the end of that, you know, right at the base of where it gets deep, there's a couple guys with a giant bonfire roaring. And we're hiking up there and we're going to camp up above them that night. And I'm thinking to myself, it's like, do I go down there and try to politely engage with these fellas? Cause I'm going to be up there with my kids, or do I don't. And I didn't in that case. Yeah. What do you think? I mean, do you have advice for that? And I know I'm putting you in the corner there because it's hard to give good advice in that situation. But
yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of great people camping out on the forest. Mm-hmm. The vast majority, I'd say, are great people.
Yep.
There are some people who you do not want to engage with,
yeah.
You know, in any level. And I have folks, we have a prevention crew. There's 8 people. And basically during high fire danger, their job is to drive around the forest and contact everybody. And they have some sketchy contacts yeah. with people. And sometimes it's just like, you know, you just say hello and you could tell, oh, nope, you know, and oh, I got to go. The radio's going. I have another call.
Right.
And these folks are not trained law enforcement officers. They don't have a badge. They don't have a gun. They're just like me. It's a job I used to do back in the day, except it's just changed with the different kind of people that are out there. And so it's difficult. I don't want people to not be engaged in helping us.
Right.
However,
you can't advise people to get themselves in that situation.
Anytime you go up to somebody out on the forest, yeah. and a lot of people are great and they don't know, but then there are people who don't want to see anybody. They're out there to be left alone. And yep. if they see anybody, it could be a dangerous situation. Yeah,
especially folks it's trying tough. To tell them what to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a tough one. So, we've got, poor camping practices, chains on trailers. I'm sure folks burning pine needles, things like that. Airbnbs, with charcoal grills,
yeah.
any big things we're missing here?
No, I think those are most of it. I mean, okay. The human cause, a lot of times it's because somebody wanted a campfire or to cook over a charcoal grill.
Right.
And they just don't realize that it really only takes one spark. And the spark floating away, just because you don't see it start a fire right then, it could sit overnight
yep.
and flare mm-hmm. up. And that happens all of the time. So
yeah.
Just because they see it and no problem, drive away. It could be something that a lot of times our calls come in the next day after we get a lot of the calls for abandoned campfires are obviously on Monday and sometimes Tuesday because folks left on Sunday. They left their fire and then it just kept smoldering or it just escaped. And a lot of those just wind up being, 20 feet outside of the yeah. fire ring and not much. But that's when we hear about them because they just linger on. Folks thought it was out.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it wasn't.
And that's a funny thing. It's because, I like to enjoy a campfire too when mm-hmm. I'm out. And I consider myself a pretty responsible person. But depending on conditions, I mean, there are conditions where I simply won't have a fire. But depending on conditions, when you have some smoldering coals in there and you've only got a little bit of water left for your camping trip, I find myself sitting there, weighing my options. Should I douse this with the last of my water, or I know it's going to be fine if I go to bed, but it's also, there's a risk there, and that's a tough call to make sometimes for even responsible people, I think. But, all right. So we've talked about forest thinning. We've talked about prescribed fire and letting some of these wildfires burn out as a safety measure and also a measure of just restoring our forest. And we've talked a bit about education, like what Alex is doing here. What we haven't talked much about is some of the regulation. So can we talk about some of the regulations that are in place now? Mm-hmm. And we can talk about and can we talk about maybe I'm going too far here. Maybe I'm not. But, I think it's a kind of a bitter pill to swallow to consider potential annual closings of our national forests. I mean, mm-hmm. these are our public lands. And I don't think anybody wants to see that. Yeah. But also we also want to live here safely as well.
Yeah. So right now, I think since the 80s, maybe longer, there is a very large area surrounding the city of Flagstaff and adjacent communities mm-hmm. Where camping and campfires are prohibited. And okay. it's been like that since the 80s. Both of our human caused fires last year, Tunnel and Pipeline, started in an area where fires are prohibited year round.
Okay.
So stage 1, 2 restrictions don't even matter because fires were prohibited there. But people couldn't help themselves.
Right.
You know, when you talk about bad apple, like, you know, just some people just can't help themselves. And there are plenty of signs out there saying, you know, no camping and no campfires. Like, we've got a lot of signs. Gotcha. You have to really work to not see them. So that area already exists. And we're tweaking that a little bit this year. We have an area that's closed to campfires, but open to camping. And that's actually where the pipeline fire started. And we're going to go ahead and change that and close that to camping entirely. And really, it's kind of a situation where we're punishing everybody for the misdeeds of a few. You know, a really popular area that we're including in there is Friedland Prairie Road, right at the base of the peaks. It's a really popular camping area, dispersed area. It's one of the nicest spots on the forest. It's been closed to campfires forever. Some people just can't help themselves. They can't control themselves. And that's a spot that's particularly concerning because it's right there adjacent to the wilderness boundary and the slope just goes right up the peaks. Mm-hmm. And if a fire were to get out from there, there'd really be nothing anybody could do about it if it was any wind or if it was particularly dry. So that's one thing we're doing is kind of expanding that no camping area. And that's because that enforcing that 14-day stay limit's a real challenge for us. Due to, you know, the law, like we have to see people almost 14 days in a row, or they can go to court and they say, oh no, on day 8, I left and I went to my friend's house and then I came back. And we all know that's not probably not true, but can you prove it? No, you can't. So in this case, where folks are out there, we've had this problem. If we see them out there camping, if we see them out there setting up, or if we see them, we get out there, you know, in the morning and obviously they were there for the night and they've got their tent set up, then it's much easier to enforce and provide that additional layer of protection. Beyond that, we have annual fire restrictions, which are based on current conditions, based on a series of indices that we measure year round. And so right now we're in stage zero, you might say, because there's still a foot of snow on half of the forest. But we have stage one restrictions, which is the forest starts to dry out. And that is where campfires are prohibited out on the forest in dispersed sites. They are still permitted in campgrounds and picnic areas. And the reason for that is that those sites are developed. They've got a big fire ring. Mm-hmm. They generally have a good amount of clearance around them. And a lot of all of our campgrounds have campground hosts who can kind of police/babysit a little bit. And so if they see, you know, just giant bonfire, they can do something about it or call us very quickly. And then as we move through the season and it gets warmer and drier, we oftentimes go into stage two restrictions. And that's when fires are prohibited anywhere on the forest, including in campgrounds, including in picnic areas. That's also when the city and the county, almost always we go into this together along with the Kaibab National Forest, where open fires are prohibited. So that's where you can't even have one in your backyard fire pit, because the risk of that spark or that ember is too great. And so that generally, stage one usually happens around mid-May into early June. And this is, you know, it varies. Like I said, 2019, no restrictions. Then stage two usually is around early June through monsoon season, which is around July 10th for us. Usually 4 to 5 weeks of that stage two restriction. And the reason that I'm mentioning, you know, the duration of that is because one of the big changes that we're going to be making this year to our restrictions is during that stage two restriction, we are going to be establishing several areas on the forest that we are going to close to motorized use.
Okay.
A big one there is basically the entirety of the San Francisco peaks. So from Highway 89 to Buffalo Park, to 180 up to the 418 road, which is basically a forest road that just runs along the northern side of the peaks. So during stage two restrictions, if we go into stage two restrictions, we're going to close the gates and not allow people to drive in there. And really the big impact there is in the Hart Prairie area, the 151 road.
Right.
Private landowners, of course, still be able to go in and access their property. The 516, which is, I'm sorry, I constantly use numbers. That's how we talk about them, which is the Snowball Road. That'll remain open to Snowball and also Kachina Trailhead and Humphreys Trailhead, our most popular summer trailheads.
Right.
And then that area, folks will still be able to hike, bike, walk their dogs, jog, ride their horse, whatever they want to do, because we have found, and I don't have an exact percentage that I can give you, but when we have a human caused fire, I will say at least 90%, probably more, are within sight of a motor vehicle.
Okay.
Almost always. Do we have backpackers who go in? Backpackers, a lot of times, like Arizona Trail, they don't want to mess around with a fire, right? They just hiked 15 miles. They want to eat, go to sleep, wake up the next morning and start walking again, right? And then, you know, maybe a family backpacking may choose to have a fire, and that could, you know, that could escape, although during restrictions, you know, hopefully they wouldn't do that. But that's kind of the big change that we're proposing. And we saw that last year. I believe the tunnel fire started near a vehicle. We know the pipeline fire started right near a motor vehicle. Almost all of the human caused fires that we see, you know, if you investigate them, somebody was there and they drove away, or they might still be there. It was a campfire that got out. Yeah. And so we think that that strikes the right balance of every acre is still open to the public.
Yep.
You can still get out there because we don't want to close anything any more than anybody else does. Mm-hmm. Because if we get to stage three where we actually close to public use, you know, I can't go. I love to run over here on the east side, you know, on the forest trails every day. And then you see me running around on the sidewalks and it kills me. Right. So we don't want to close the forest to public use. But in this case, all of our trailheads will be open. Fat Man's Loop trailhead, Sandy Seep trailhead on Highway 89, all the trailheads on 180. So folks will still be able to access their public land. We'll just be keeping motor vehicles out because the vast majority of the fires start near those. And again, like you said, bad apples earlier.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of good people will not be able to drive for that 4 to 5 weeks on average. And okay. I keep going back to 2019 when we had no restrictions at all. Hopefully we won't have to do this.
Right.
But if we do get to that point of stage two restrictions, and then just to mention also two other areas where we'll be doing that. What we call, refer to kind of as Walnut Canyon, but it's the area south of Walnut Canyon.
Yeah.
Because if we had a fire that dropped into Walnut Canyon and came up the other side, that's a bad situation. And then also Pump House Wash, which is the 237 road from Kachina over to 89A. We have a lot of big dispersed camp areas in there. They're quite popular. Yeah. And however, the risk of a fire kind of coming up Pump House Wash towards Kachina is significant.
Right.
So looking at those two areas also where folks will still be able to ride their bike or walk or ride a horse on that 237 and into the trails, but just trying to provide an additional layer of protection for the community by trying to reduce those human caused fires.
Right. Yeah, that's got to be just a monumentous project to handle and juggle because and I'll take the lumps personally for this, but in my opinion, there's way too many damn two tracks in Arizona's national forest. And it's something I struggle with a lot trying to get away from that stuff. But again, it's, you know, multi-use and not everybody wants to do it the way I want to do it. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's say folks are coming up, to recreate in our national forest, in the summertime, where do they go to find out what the restrictions are?
So the Coconino National Forest website is a great place to do it. We've got a really active Twitter feed, a very active Facebook page. I think those are probably the best places. Locally here, we rely really hard on our friends at CAF News. Dave and his folks over there are just a wonderful source of information. And I don't know if people still listen to the radio driving up the freeway or if they're just on Spotify. But if you drive up the 17 on a Friday, if you happen to have CAF on, you are going to hear a very strongly worded message about fire restrictions and fire danger and how people live here and kind of almost not quite to the level of Alex's flyer, but you're going to hear that message. So I think that's, you know, our social media and our website is the best way, but also Coconino County, City of Flagstaff, we all go into these restrictions together and have a unified message around it. So we're hoping, you know, the Daily Sun also does a lot.
Yep.
So just, you know, the traditional sources, but like I said earlier, you know, getting the folks from the Valley is always tough, right? Because they're not looking at our website. Like they know, I go to this spot off the 700 road every year. I'm just going to go to my spot. Like, and they don't really think about, I'm not going to look at the, why would I look at the website? I know where I'm going. I know where the road is. I know where to turn.
Right.
I don't care about that. I'm not on Facebook. I don't care about Twitter. And so, you know, what Alex and her group are doing or hoping can help reach, you know, folks in Airbnbs, but also those other folks that are just coming to visit, whether they're in an RV, or an Airbnb.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'll tell you what. None of us here are climate scientists. None of us here can predict the future, but let's try a little bit. What does the future look like? Do you think we could have annual closures? You know, I bought a home up here last year and I paid way too much for it because I want to live in a pretty spot surrounded by national forests. And it the idea of it burning up is a real concern for me. you know, what is Flagstaff going to look like in 20 years? You know, what are the regulations going to be? What, any ideas there from either of you? I know it's a tough, and I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but I'm curious because I want to be here in 20 years.
Yeah, same.
So, you know, when you asked about the forest closure piece is something I can speak to. And like I said, I think three of the last 5 years, we've had some sort of forest closure. And I think in 2018, we closed, I'm doing air quotes for folks listening, closed the forest, the entire forest. That's basically close all the gates, try to chase people out. One of the things that we know to be true is a lot of people still stay.
Yep.
In there behind the gates.
They, oh boy, it'd be a great time for somebody like
me. They get wind that we're doing it, and they dig in, they hide, they hide in the forest. They're like, I don't have anywhere else to go. Where am I going to go? Right. And then they still decide they need to make dinner, and they're going to use a fire to do that. So those forest closures can reduce the danger, but they don't reduce it to zero. I think a lot of folks think, oh, if you close the forest, there's not going to be human caused fire.
Right.
And that's not true. And it's hard. So closing the entire forest where not every acre has as much, fire danger as every other acre. So that's where we're focusing in on some of these smaller areas, either the entirety of the peaks, Pump House Wash, Walnut Canyon. And those are areas where we have done area closures. So we're doing the stage two non-motorized thing, kind of bridge the gap, because stage two, it's fire danger is increasing, but it's not extreme. However, if we have any kind of wind event, which just happens for a day and then it's over. Like, we can't just close the forest for a day. Like, we can't mobilize that quickly to close all the gates and get everybody out. So that's where that stage two, that those additional restrictions, we're trying to bridge that gap. And then if we get to a stage three, it's certainly something our forest supervisor will consider if closing the forest is the right idea. What we do is base this on a series of indices, like 1 hour, 10 hour, 1,000 hour fuel moisture. And so what that is 1 hour fuels are fine fuels that will carry fire quickly. 1,000 hour fuels are big tree. You know, that it takes a lot for it to catch on fire, but once it does, it is on fire.
All right.
And then we have, you know, wind, humidity, weather forecast, a lot of things that factor into that. And that's where we try to base our decisions on science. There is some professional expertise going in there. Like I said, our fire folks have seen fire behavior change. So I think they're factoring that in and potentially maybe pulling the trigger on some sort of restrictions, maybe a week or two earlier than they would have in the past. And so that's something that we're trying to factor in. But folks, you know, we definitely want folks to know that we base these on the data that is collected, and that it's not just, you know, Matt sitting in his office saying, I think things are fine this week, we'll leave it open. Oh, I feel like it's going to be windy. Right. We're going to close it.
Well, thank goodness we have professional agencies and folks like you staying on top of this stuff. It makes me feel a little bit better anyway.
Yeah. And in terms of the future, a dream I have is, I don't know why Flagstaff's not synonymous with fire safety. Like, that's my dream for Flagstaff. And I can't speak, like you said, I'm not a climate scientist and can't speak to other communities, but that would be my hope, is that as a community, we, rather than feeling dejected or helpless or angsty, that we take, you know, little steps to make our community known as fire safety. So anyone coming up from Phoenix, especially, right? That's our neighbor, knows, oh, better be careful. Like, that should just be.
Right.
So that's our goal. And I don't know, you know, it's lots of little steps towards it and all of us working together. But, you know, we're in summer two, season two of doing this, and hope to just grow.
Yeah. No, I mean, just sitting here, I there's so many directions you could go with this. Yeah. It's exciting.
Yeah.
Thanks. Looking at my crystal ball, I can't predict the future. I do think, is it going to keep getting warmer and drier? Probably. Yeah. However, I'm really optimistic about the future of Flagstaff. And one is because of people like Alex and Fired Up Flagstaff doing that education. I think we can get to the place where the community, I mean, I think our community itself is fire safe, but then having our visitors also be fire safe. And then also, we're doing an awful lot of work in the most sensitive areas, the Forest Service is, to provide that additional layer of protection for the community. So an example is this year and next year, we'll be offering. And so offering is basically how many acres of commercial thinning we're going to do. 13 to 14,000 acres. Most of them are on the west side of the peaks and what we call the upper Rio drainage.
Yep.
An area, you know, folks say if that area burns, then Flagstaff could potentially be unlivable for quite a while.
Yeah.
So a lot of that work, 4,000 of those acres will be out for bid either in 2 weeks or in like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And so that probably won't get cut this year, but maybe next year or the year after. And then we'll have the opportunity after that to go in with prescribed fire. And that's really when we have done the best we can as humans to mimic natural conditions there. And so, and then in the meantime, while we, We can't do that overnight. That's where that people management piece comes in. And that's where this, our change in fire restrictions is coming in, is to how can we manage human behavior as best as we can? We know what a challenge that is. How can we manage human behavior to reduce the number of human caused ignitions? And then, you know, maybe we'll have, you know, there's still, you can't predict the lightning at all.
Right.
Although one thing that is kind of interesting in looking back at our stats, we've had fewer lightning caused fires over the last 50 years, and just talking to folks and they just say, yeah, the monsoon has changed over time. It is moderated. It is not as strong as it used to be. And not only is that in terms of precipitation, not necessarily last year, but the number of lightning strikes that we've had, which is really interesting way to see how the climate has changed.
Yeah. I personally really love the prescribed fire aspect of all this. I worked for the Department of Natural Resources back in the Ozarks, and I got to work on pretty much all aspects of prescribed fire. But what I loved the most was after we'd have fire on a landscape piece of property a couple times, we could go in and we could see grasses coming up that we had not seen basically in the history of that park, that had just been there dormant, you know, for countless years, just waiting to come back. And so for me, you know, from the natural history perspective, it is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to do with my yard. All right, guys, what have we left out here? I think we've covered a lot.
Anything? Yeah. I just would give my phone number one more time. Please. In our email. So it's phone number is 928-421-2444. And you can text or call and then email us at firedupflagstaff@gmail.com.
Okay. So folks that want these pamphlets, say they have an Airbnb or they live next to an Airbnb, they can get these from you.
Yeah, absolutely.
What if they just want to help? What if they want to be part of the solution?
We would love that. That would be wonderful. Shoot me a note and we can chat. And if there are other communities, we know that the Airbnb, the short-term rentals in neighborhoods and fire, you know, prone communities is not restricted to Flagstaff. So contact us if you want to adapt these to your community.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And Matt, I'm going to assume you don't want to give your phone number, but I would say definitely follow Coconino National Forest on Facebook, Twitter. Tune into the CAF if you're out wanting to go explore your national forest.
And actually, CAF's Twitter and Facebook, you know, I'm not financially invested in them, I promise, but it's just the greatest source of information for Northern Arizona.
They are good.
Whether it's fire or anything else that's going on.
Well, I genuinely want to thank both of you for being here today, and I want to thank you for the work that you do, not only because I love these forests, but also I live here. So a little bit selfishly there as well. But seriously, thanks for the work.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
Awesome. Well, that is a lot of information to digest, huh? A lot of great information and important stuff to keep in mind. I know everyone listening to this podcast loves our forests and our diversity here in Arizona and our deserts, which are burning these days too. So take that stuff to heart. Think about it. Educate others. It's extremely important, you know, not only for the health and resiliency of our woods and waters and deserts, but also for residents and the safety of people. A lot of folks lost their homes up here this past fire season. And oh my God, that's a tragedy. You know, I can't even imagine. So take that stuff seriously and pass that information along. Please share this podcast any way you can. All right. Well, let's see. You know that this podcast is made possible by the Arizona Wildlife Federation. Again, we are 100 years old this year. I'm going to keep tooting that horn as much as I can because I'm very proud of it. Keep an eye peeled. There are rumblings about a big old birthday party later this year. You know, if that comes to fruition, which I'm thinking it's going to, I want you all to be there. This organization I think we're on the right side of conservation, and you know, we try to keep it, we keep it science-based, we keep it pragmatic, and I think that's where conservation needs to be. And you know, we've done it a long time. We're getting pretty good at it. So if you would like to support the Arizona Wildlife Federation, you can do so by checking out our website. There'll be a link in the show notes below. And you're welcome to support us by making a donation. You'll get our quarterly magazine that way. It's a great magazine. I promise you'll like it. And be part of something good. Also, most importantly, don't hesitate to reach out to Alex and help her with her program. If you live near an Airbnb or you know someone who has Airbnbs, get a hold of her, get a hold of some of these great and funny pamphlets that will educate folks to the dangers of fire up here around the Flagstaff community. And yeah, get those distributed out. Help her out any way you can. She's doing good work and making a difference, and that's appreciated. So I know you enjoy the show, so I'm not even going to ask. And I hope, hell, I know you learned a lot too. So we will see you again in 2 weeks with another show from the Arizona Wildlife Federation podcast. Thanks for listening.